Welcome to the pod, everyone. A shout out to SGS.
Hey, Rusty, why are we partnering with SGS?
Some good people there. Pretty excited about their sports coaching courses and sports courses. Keen to make them industry ready, so when people leave, they're able to go and transfer it to any kind of industries, coaching, teaching, being an analyst, business, whatever it might be. So I think it's pretty exciting times, really.
So what's so special about their degree courses that others won't be doing?
I think it'll be lots of real good partnerships, opportunities for people to get into different contexts and learn and practice. It'll be feel very applied. People will be stretched and supported and will leave ready to just go and thrive in the big old world out there.
SGS College is the home of Bristol's higher education sports programmes. The programmes are designed to develop unique, innovative and creative sports practitioners ready for industry. Do you want to be a coach or teacher of the future? Start your journey here at SGS College and become more than just a graduate. Visit sgscol.ac.uk to apply now.
Cool, I'm super excited. James G, all the way from the US. James, thank you so much for coming on. I've probably stood on the shoulders of yourself and Amy Price over the last kind of 18 months of my life since video game design entered my world. I'm going to thank you for that personally now. But
you're welcome.
It's great to have you on. And yeah, look, do you want to kind of introduce yourself and tell everyone how we've got to this situation where I'm chatting to you now?
I will. My name is Jim G. And in January 2020, the year we're in, I retired after a long career at several different universities as a linguist. And weirdly, when I retired in 2020, the whole world retired with me and went home. I didn't know I had been that meaningful to them. I spent the early part of my career doing theoretical linguistics, grammar, syntax, semantics, then got much more involved with the social, cultural aspects of language, which led me to also learning, because language and learning are intimately related. And when I was 53, about 2000, I had a six-year-old child, because by that time I had worked in literacy and learning, and I knew that literacy really does require you to read with your kid interactively, you know, ask questions, get the kid to respond, you know. I knew there were digital books like Winnie the Pooh, and I used those because, you know, you're interacting with the kid and the screen's interacting, right? Things are happening and the kid's pushing stuff and it happens. And so it's interactive, mentored literacy, and I knew that was good. And then one day I saw a kid's game called Who's Afraid, a Pajama Sam Who's Afraid of the Dark. And I hadn't played any games, but I had done these digital books with him, and I got that game and we played it together. It's a great game. It's puzzle solving with a story. It was just like a book in the sense that we sat there and talked interactively. But what was very interesting is we had to talk about solving problems together, make hypotheses, and then kind of assess them and do them. And at some things he was better than me, and some things I was better at him, but we could supplement it. And I thought, well, at a literacy level, at a learning level, this is great. Because learning and literacy for young kids is really a matter of interacting with adults with lots of talk so that their vocabulary expands, their cognitive thinking and problem-solving skills expand. And so this looked good. And I enjoyed the game. I thought it was a lot of fun. And so I one day went and bought a game arbitrarily that was more for older people, you know, and adults. It's called The Adventures of the New Time Machine. It's not famous by any means. I just picked it probably because it reminded me of H.G. Wells, and took it home and thought that it would be as fun as playing Pajama Sam. And it was an utter horror show. I found myself utterly unable to do it. It was horribly hard. I tried reading the manual. Those days, the games came with a manual. I couldn't make heads or tails of it. It certainly didn't do anything to help me play the game. And my first response was, wow, people pay for this? This is a toy. It's a game. Why would anybody pay for this? Something about it. The other thing I realized, though, wow, I've never been this bad a learner in the past. And then I said, no, like many older people, I haven't had to learn anything fundamentally new for a long time. We older people have lots of experience. We use that experience. We look smart. We'll always beat a young person if that experience is required. But put us against a 12-year-old where it's brand new and our experience doesn't help us, and he's way smarter. So as I stuck with it, I saw this is like my learning muscles are expanding for the first time since graduate school. And I thought, wow, this is both hell and heaven. And I got better. I learned a lot of the stuff. I eventually found it extremely life-enhancing to play the game. And as any academic, I said, whoa, I better start writing about this because I want to keep my job and they pay me to write and do research. But the real insight I had while playing was I did know from my work in the learning sciences that there were a lot of principles about how humans learn that are at the cutting edge of research, but do not exist in our schools. But I saw they all existed in the video game. And it hit me as an educator at the time and a language and learning person. Why would our toys have the cutting edge learning principles that best fit human learning, but our schools don't? And I thought, that's a real mystery, and it'd be interesting to look into it. So I wrote a book about it. It was a lot of fun to write it because I was basically just describing my own play and what principles were in it. You could call it an autoethnography. And I had no idea the book would go anywhere. I didn't know at the time that the game industry was just about to break open as the independent games came around. You didn't need big publishers. It was going to explode into other niches than just pure entertainment. I didn't know that. Maybe lots of people didn't know that. So I was writing at a time which very soon the whole industry needed some academic with credibility to say video games were good and promising. And so the book really took off. Wired did an article on it wrote a little piece on it before it came out. And it sold very well because the time was right for it, right? It was, people wanted to really explore what this technology could do beyond shooting, you know? So that really changed my career because that gave me access to and interactions with people in places I never would have done, including military, business people. Later on, when I put learning in games into the curriculum at the University of Wisconsin, my first graduate student to graduate with games became the first advisor on games and learning to the White House Office of Science and Technology. So I was at the White House, and this was all because of my six-year-old.
Wow. Well, there's a lot going on there. I'm reading your book now, and I loved, you said, I was born in 1948. For heaven's sake, why am I playing games? And worse still, why am I writing about it? So we've got a bit of insight there. I was really intrigued. You said it was a life-enhancing experience. So it sounded like it was quite frustrating. And
it is. So what you find out, and again, research does this, is if I originally looked at it just as a failure and then said, well, that failure's in me, right? Is something wrong with me? That's the typical thing we do because we were taught that in school. But I had studied enough and learned enough and enough of a kind of a iconoclast that I said, no, I came to realize the failure is not in me. It's like I'm learning a new sport and it doesn't use the same muscles as the other sport. So of course I'm not good at it. I wasn't good at the sport that I'm an expert in now when I started. But in fact, when I was learning theoretical linguistics, while I, in the beginning, understood next to nothing, I found it very enjoyable because I knew it was going to lead to what I wanted to do. Once I got that attitude, which they now call grit, but it just is being motivated to go on because you have changed your perspective, then I found it life-enhancing. And I also, as every gamer learns to do, redefine failure as a form of learning and opportunity and not a statement about yourself. In fact, of course, I came to realize if you buy a video game, in those days in particular, and it's easy and you never fail, you return it. See, this was the thing that hit me. And I used to say, if when we tell a kid you're going to have to learn algebra and it's going to be hard, it's going to be difficult, there'll be a lot of failure, the kid says, not for me, you can keep it. Now we offer them a game, and if that game is too easy or too short, they return it and say, give me a hard one. Give me one where I'll fail a lot. They don't do that in school. What if the kid said, this algebra is too easy? You got to make it harder. I got to fail more. See, they do that in games. They don't do that in school. Why? Yeah. Why is the kid not upset? In fact, he won't even accept a product that dumbs it down.
Yeah, I wrote down as soon as you mentioned failure, like in my world, it would be a learning opportunity. Often in school, it's not seen like that. It's
socially, it's a statement.
It's not held like that. And definitely in sport, it's rarely seen like that. Even from a young age, actually will... It'll be the way the adults behave around failure often that means that the kids suddenly has this. Well, actually, it's not a learning opportunity.
Yeah, yeah. In video games, you certainly want to fail. And when you face the first boss, if you beat it on two strikes, you say this is a stupid game. You do demand that the failure gives you feedback, right? And then it's enjoyable because each time you make progress. And that's certainly what you want to do. But in school, there is only one winner. The person who gets the highest A is the winner. Everybody else is a loser, right? Because it's a hierarchy. You can't have a team if there's only one winner, right? Nobody's going to collaborate. So, you know, the state of schools is most people end up feeling a failure because they were told it's about assessment. And they weren't at the top. It's an interesting thing. Kids hate assessment and testing in school. But if you think about it, a video game is really just all assessment. You're being assessed every minute. You immediately know this worked or didn't work, and you love it. But in school, you hate it.
Yeah, it's I just wrote down there again, it's something I've been thinking a lot about, is how can classrooms feel more collaborative? So even I've been in a couple of schools and been thinking about how we could apply these principles, but even to the extent that me helping support you, maybe I'm someone who gets the concept let's do it the other way. You understanding it, James, and then helping me, which is probably more likely.
No.
Then that helps us advance as a group. Then
yes.
we should surely be encouraging that type of...
We should, and you as a sports person know how to do that, because take a game like soccer or American football, baseball. Those games are made in such a way that a single person can't win them. They can't even play them. You can't play baseball all by yourself. Why is that? That's because you set up a problem that cannot be solved by one person. And cannot be solved by one skill, right? What is baseball? It's a problem that requires 9 different skills collaborating, or you can't succeed, right? Now, in school, what we do is we say we're going to do group work, but we give a problem that the smartest kid in the group can solve all by himself. The problem doesn't require multiple skills, and it only requires the multiple skills the smartest person has. So, you know, think about it. Kids would rather play soccer where they have a skill base that they collaborate with others towards a problem that requires everybody than they would in school, where really they know it's all about what you can do. And in fact, you know, in American schools, if you put kids into a group and you say to them, you know, you're going to get a group score, you have to collaborate, you have to use different skills, especially the most well-off kids will rebel. They do not want to participate in any grading that they'd have to share with others. Right? They don't want to collaborate because they see it's a winner take all game. And so if you have this attitude that collaboration is an opportunity for other people to cheat you or for you to fail because of them, and therefore you want to just do it all on your own, how good do you think you're going to fare in our complex world when you get out of school?
It's a good question. I mean, most parents, by the way, of those kids would also probably be against the collaboration. The interesting thing for me is whenever I've gone in and used it as a thought experiment in schools, one of the first things that they've brought in is collaboration and is recognizing different skills. So I did it with a drama group, and they said, well, actually, if someone has a skill around lighting, then they can support people with that. And then if someone has a skill around this, and then as a team, I said, oh, how many of your lessons look like this? And they were like, none of our lessons look like this.
Yeah, see, so the world operates this way now, though. So as you just pointed out, in a play, you have different skill sets. Furthermore, the interesting thing is the different skill sets, though, have to learn enough about each other's skill set in order to collaborate, right? This is what in business is called a cross-functional team. Everybody has a separate skill, but I have to understand yours enough to truly help you. And even if necessary, to replace you if you're gone, right? So I learn a vision of your skill so I can collaborate it and make my skill. It's not just that I'm stuck in my skill. That lighting person knows a hell of a lot about what the actors are doing and what the people who built the stage are doing, right? They have to, because they have to do their job in a way that supplements and helps the other job. When you do that, there can't be one person succeeding. And humans are, oddly enough, at their best when they feel that they matter to each other. And in a classroom where everybody's competing with everybody else, you don't feel you matter to others. You only matter to the authorities that tell you you're either a failure or a success. In a team that's really functioning, you know, even though you might not be the best player, you certainly matter because they can't play without a first baseman.
Yeah, I wonder how many teachers are thinking of belonging as a critical part of their curriculum almost.
They better start, because, you know, you can say in the messy world we live in now with violence and conflict and environmental degradation and many people voting for people like Trump, that it is a problem of belonging. Human beings are built by their very evolution to profoundly care about what others think of them. And they absolutely, like any herd animal, deeply want to belong and be accepted and feel that what they do matters to others. And there's plenty of evidence that shows that if you do not have that, you will get mentally and physically sick. The trouble is this, that humans will find that sense of belonging and worth wherever they can get it. So if you exclude them from good groups and good causes, they'll go to Nazis, they'll go to white spirit, they'll go where they can find that it matters, they matter, because that's a human urge. So teachers who are not activating that urge in a good way are going to leave and especially if you're excluding people, they feel that they don't matter, they will find it in another place, like a gang. So it's dangerous to leave people not feeling they matter. And by the way, there's tremendously important research that shows that the more inequality you have in a society, and America has the highest level of inequality it's had, so does Britain, the higher the level of the inequality, the more people in that society, not just poor people, the more people in that society feel that what they do doesn't really matter. And then you get sicker and sicker people, not just poor people. Loads of Americans who are middle class, some of whom are well off, feel it doesn't matter. The game's rigged. It only matters the billionaires and the power. Once you get that setting, once inequality makes a large number of people not care, you get the very mess we're in. People then are searching for caring in the wrong places.
Yeah, it's it would be something that I mean, spent a bit of time working with some people around people joining gangs, and one of the biggest predictors was shaming. And often we don't necessarily think we are, but in education and sport, we are shaming people in front of their peers. We're excluding them.
That's right.
That what they do doesn't matter or have meaning. And we might not be doing it even that overtly. We might actually be just doing it and not really knowing it, but it's,
Right.
And so what would it, I mean, I love the way you talk about like subjects as games. I think you reference, you know, you play the game of biology. What would that look like? So you talk about some of the stuff at the university. What would that look like on a practical level? So give me step inside the world of a James G curriculum. What does that look like?
Well, so let me go to a question you and I have talked about before, and that is why are the learning principles that are in good games, in games and used in the military now, used all the time out of school? People are creating this sort of learning in various interest-driven, passion-driven spaces and groups, but it's not in our schools. See, it goes back to the original question. Why is the video game got cutting edge principles of learning and teaching and assessment in it, but they're not in the school? Well, if people always say, well, that's just because the school is doing what it's supposed to do poorly. I don't think that's true. I think the school's doing very well what it intends to do, which is to sort people, right? The school is there to be standardized, to have a lot of products sold to a mass market, to sort people into various groups for a highly unequal society. It is not there to make everybody a success. It's not there to win the game of human belonging and human learning. It's there to win the game of standardizing for an economy that is highly unequal. So the school has very little incentive to take these curriculum, which is why, and I've written about this, the best examples of how this learning works are out of school, right? Where let's say, in the days the World of Warcraft was hugely popular, many people formed guilds and began to get into groups you had to have different skills. The hunting party is a classic cross-functional team, right? Each person in it had a different skill. If you had to understand the other skills to use your skill, if anybody didn't use their skills properly and coordinate them, then you lost. And people then created what I've called affinity spaces. That is, they got on the internet and did all sorts of stuff with each other, theory crafting, reviewing, modding. So they were producing and not just consuming. They were then making their own apps to put in the game to improve their learning. So here you have really what you could call learning community using, again, cutting edge principles, base it on action, on collaboration, on what you care about, on goals and action. So out of school. So and what is happening and is that we have two school systems today. If you wanted to be an expert in anything and you had some good mentorship, you could go out on the internet and find affinity spaces, you know, interest-driven groups that are organized in a way that you like, and you would go to multiple sites. Some of them would end up in the real world, and you would be mentored, given the right experiences, all based on producing and not just consuming, and you would end up, whether you're 12, with real expertise if you wanted it. You'd have to have grit. You'd have to keep going. You'd have to care. And you can't really do that in school very successfully. So we have a school system out of school that is pretty damn good and getting better and better. And we have the same old bad school system. But for the first time, the school system has real competition, right? So your question about what would I do with school goes to a political question, and it's one that each person has to make their own mind on. You know, for many years, the MacArthur Foundation, after I wrote my book, got very big into funding the games and learning movement, and so because I was early in it, I had a lot of their money for years, millions of dollars. They spent $88 million on this. They didn't give it all to me, but they were trying to. The whole point was is they knew school learning was moribund, so they wanted to do highly innovative teaching and learning, and then move it to school. And the dilemma arose that if you do highly innovative things and then move them to the schools we have, the school will co-opt it, right? It will. So, and you see this all the time. You move a good game based learning with a game or with anything, based on problem solving and collaboration and stuff, you move that to school pretty soon. Each kid's at their desk by themselves doing it with grading, right? So the school, the question, can I bring true innovation? The sort that says we're supposed to win the game of learning, not the game of sorting. Can I bring that to the sorting factory? You can't. You have to change the paradigm of schooling. Now, when people say, well, we can't do that, and that's unfair to all these kids, well, the paradigm's already changed out of school. So the first advice I'd give any parent where the school is failing their kid is go get some young people who know how affinity spaces work, get the kid interested in something, put them in those. It could be citizen science, it could be robotics, it could be modding. Find a passion for the kid, get him in that out of school system. He's going to end up not only very smart, but with real skills for jobs. The first thing is if the school's failing you and you don't know about all this out of school learning, go find out about it. Go to somebody who does. The second thing is we could change schools, and you know, the virus is maybe going to start this. Why are we stuck in a room in the age of affinity spaces? Why, if I want to give my class a problem like that cannot be solved by one person, requires multiple skills, it, like a sport, and takes time. Each person has to learn the skill. Then they have to learn the other people's skills enough to coordinate with it. And to do that, why would I think all the resources for that are in my one room with my one teacher? Because whatever that problem is, let's say it was solving the drought problem in the Southwest. Well, God, there is billions of internet spaces, real spaces, labs all over the country that you could network with, so you want to create an affinity space, and you want your classroom to be just one space connected to many others, some of them virtual, some of them real, with the people traveling through them, because then they get many mentors, many teachers. And then sometimes they're in a space where they've learned a lot so they can teach. Now, so you see, the thing is, this, you'd also in this world want to find your passion. And unless a kid can sample lots of interests, you know, so let's say you sample modding for games and you find it interesting. You know why it turns people on, but it's not your passion. Great. But for some people, they find that it's their passion. They become computer scientists. They become engineers, right? Every kid, school should be about sampling many interests, but with the insistence that you find a passion. And then also the insistence that you can teach your passion to other people when they need some help from it. And that's how I would do school. But you see, I don't know how they do it in England. America doesn't want to pay for schools. Remember, we fund schools by property tax. That means rich neighborhoods have a lot more money for their kids than the poor neighborhoods. And guess what? For very wealthy families, and I've done interviews that show this, the kids and the parents, if asked, do you learn more out of school than in school? The richer kids say out of school. And they don't mean by joining gangs. They mean by all the resources they can get with supercomputers and spaces they can go to and all the advantages they get, because they think that what they learn out of school is much more relevant to their futures. They certainly think school is important, but as a credential, right? So our rich people are in both school systems, the out of school and the in school. And the poor kids are in schools that don't even resource them with the same amount of money the rich schools have.
Definitely.
It's not a system. I would never ask in a system like, how can we keep it as it is, but just make it a little bit better? It's like asking, you know, how can we make this jail a little bit more humane without changing any of our torture practices?
Yeah, it probably needs a bit of Google's 10x thinking, would be my view. And I actually agree. I mean, I still encounter lots of kids who are getting on 17, 18, 19 and still don't know what their passion is. And I think we're missing some opportunities there. The other stuff I was interested in, and clearly the gaming would afford this, is actually what's the function of a teacher, and actually good mentorship and perhaps using the wisdom of the elders. And I think that's probably what happens in the video game design. I want to kind of delve into it a little bit. So you've, in both your book and in your art, the stuff Good Learning, which I really enjoy, you start to talk about some of the principles. So just some of the things that resonated with me that I was curious to kind of get your take on. So identity is something I'm really, from probably more from a team perspective than an individual, but actually something that I'm really passionate about. So where does identity fit into this?
Well, so identity is crucial to it, because it's the thing that motivates you to want to be something new, right? When you're learning, you're not just coming to know more, you're coming to become something else. So, you know, I played a lot of sports as a kid and I coached a bit. When you are starting out as a little kid in America, because baseball is kind of our national pastime, you want to be a ball player, right? You're out with your dad throwing a ball around. You have baseball cards and you want to become a baseball player. You don't really know what it means, right? Because the whole community around you, starting with little t-ball, is going to induce you into a path towards becoming a baseball player, and then you know what it means. And of course, if you're being in mentored to this in a good community, you know it is a collaborative thing, and you know you don't have to be a major league baseball player to be a baseball player, that's the way it is. See, so let's take science in school. A kid is going to learn this only, so to be a scientist, you have to think in a certain way. You have to have certain values. You have to do things in a certain way. And so let's call that an identity, right? Because scientists, you know, do and talk science, but when they're at a bar, they're not doing that. They're a different person. If they're a cricket expert, they're not doing that when they're being a cricket expert. They're doing that when they're being a scientist. The kid says, if he's going to learn science, what do? We just teach him a bunch of facts. But that isn't science. Science is not memorizing facts. It's using facts to do actions, to solve problems. Now, to do that, you have to have the value system and the behavior system and the thinking system and the collaboration system of scientists. Let's call that an identity. If the kid says, I don't want that identity, or I don't think you're really ever going to let me have that identity, or it doesn't fit with people like me, then that kid is not going to learn. Right. There, you see, any learning is an invitation to become something. And if you don't want it or you don't see why it's valuable, look, there are lots of kids who come from families and stuff where, well, you're a soccer guy, so I'll tell you a story. When I was in high school, I was in a boarding school. It was a seminary. We didn't leave it. And we played sports in different teams. And I played baseball and football and basketball because that's what Americans play. Soccer was just coming into America, and I did not consider it a sport. But we had it. And we were supposed to, on our team, play each sport. And I played soccer, and I said, this is the dumbest game I've ever seen. I'm one of the people down by the goal, and everybody's running at me with cleats with the ball coming. And so I said, I'm not playing this. And the team took me down and gave me a red belly and dragged me onto the field. So I had to play soccer. And you see, what I realized is I didn't get it. I didn't want to be a soccer. It was un-American. It was a stupid sport because you're just running around. I needed not just to be told the rules of the game, but to say, what do soccer players feel like? What do they value? What do you call the people that stand near the goal but aren't the goalies?
Defenders.
Yeah. When all these people are running at me with the ball, all of them with cleats, and I'm supposed to like go as one person up to all of them and try to take the ball and kick it without getting kicked. I had no idea even what to look at. I had no idea how to do that in any effective way. So many things were happening. You see, you have to I did not know how to pay attention to the right stuff so that I could problem solve. I needed a teacher called a coach that would have had a way to say, here is what you pay attention to.
Yeah, right? You reference kind of like just-in-time information and mm-hmm. almost on-demand.
Right.
In your world, would that be you just going to a coach and saying, look, I probably need a bit of help here?
No, in fact, when you're a beginner, as I was in soccer, not in the other sports. The coaches were kids. I mean, I coached some of this stuff, so we didn't have professional coaches. But any good coach, when they're starting with a beginner, or any good teacher, says, this game as it's played is too complicated for you right now,
yes.
Right? And I could sit here and give you like all the rules of chess, and you won't remember one of them when you get out there. And even if you remembered all of them, once it was action and not words, you don't know what to do. So what you do, this fish tank thing. You simplify it, right? You have drills. You would have put me out there, first of all, with only one person coming after me and say, Jim, here's one thing that I do know. Is this, I knew this from American football. If you want to know where the runner is going to go, look at their hips, right? So if somebody would have said, Jim, don't stare at the ball alone. Don't look at the guy's face because that'll just scare you. Look at his hips because that will tell you where he's going to move, right? And things like that, right? They're telling you just in time information that you can then use because then he's going to say, okay, now you do it and let's see if you can do it. And if you can't, he says again, let me show you how to do it. So it's a matter of realizing that beginners cannot play the game. But on the other hand, you see the old style learning said, well, let them drill stuff like dribbling a basketball in no context at all. That doesn't work either. Because it has to be in a context of using the dribbling in basketball in order to actually do something like dribble and pass so you create a situation where you want the skill learned, but you've simplified it enough that the person can keep practicing that skill in a realistic context. It's still basketball, but controlled, and get feedback immediately, certainly be told, we do not expect you to be good at this after you've done it only 10 times. And then you move up the complex. That same way you would do with science, right? You don't have the kid do quantum mechanics as a whole on the first day.
Yeah, I think your fish tank idea, which I think, because my memory is not that good, I might have called it a goldfish bowl and a shark tank previously. So apologies, yeah. But I think you referenced it. Just give someone the ability to practice something in context. But the other thing that I liked that you put was, but it can't be boring.
Yeah. Well, I think of it like the Mississippi River is a very complex ecosystem full of different sorts of fish and plants and environments. And if you wanted somebody to understand that and you just sent them out there and all at once, it's just too big. It's so complicated, they won't even know what to look at. So let's say you take three species of fish, little ones, a few of the plant stuff, put them in an aquarium, let the person study the interaction where the system is simple enough now that the person can practice how to see, can get intrigued. Now, it's pretty cool. You've got a baby Mississippi River in your house. That's pretty cool. And then, you know, you can make a more complicated one. And then the person's ready to go out to maybe a small creek, right? It's all real. The fish tank is, you're not doing stuff out of context. Fish tank's the context. Nice. But it's a context that's simpler in the Mississippi River, but a good designer has made it a step to the Mississippi River. Right, he knows you can go from this further steps, and then you can be out there. And by the time you're in the river, you come with a passion, with understanding, and you'll be an expert. Right, you'll be an expert.
I think it's Amy's translation of that is probably around the levels as well. So, which are one of the other things that you discuss, which is maybe how you when you first played the game was pleasant frustration.
Yes. So learning, humans learn well new things. They need to practice the old ones continually. But the new ones they learn is they have to have a problem that is not beyond their ability to solve it, but not too easy to solve. And at that zone, humans actually find the difficulty pleasurable, right? Because you're not in despair. You know you could solve this. And you know it's not so easy that any old moron could solve it. So you're in this zone that for humans is it's what Csikszentmihalyi has called flow. You all of a sudden are just gonna keep going and really get involved. And every time, see anybody who's fought a boss and you lose in a way, you say, whoa, I could not even imagine doing this. Then I start the game over and learn better. But if I get there and I've killed the boss immediately, I say, this is a bad game. But if I get that boss and I lose pretty badly, but I say, wow, I see now one thing more I can try. Oh, and now I still didn't do that well, but I did much better. Now I know I'm on a path to win. And every time I try, there's a little success in the sense that I got better. And then when you win, you feel like a genius, right? It's very, very motivating. You know, back to the thing with levels. So games come in levels, and no game starts with its hardest level,
yeah.
Right? You know, every level in a good game says you can't get out of this level unless you've solved the problems, right? That's why it's assessment. You don't get to finish the level. See, think about it. In a game, we know you mastered the level because you got out of it. It's like, would you take a player who played Halo on hard and finished? Would you then say, let's give him a Halo test?
No,
he just took the test.
Yeah, yeah.
But what do we do in school? When a kid finishes algebra, we give them an algebra test. Why? We don't trust that playing the game of algebra in school means you learned it. But we do trust in the game that getting out of the level or playing Halo and beating it means you learned it. So that's because it's better designed than our algebra. Yeah. So levels in games are devoted. So now the other thing a game does, once you finish the level, the game says, we know you are good enough to finish a level, but now we're going to give you a boss. And the boss is going to say, we're going to ramp this up because you're going to have to use the skills we kind of already know you have, but you've got to add something to it, innovate with it, move it a little further before we let you do the next level. Right. So I remember in Ninja Gaiden, the first one, very hard game, but I loved it. I played the first level. It took me a while to get through it. And then I played it several more times. But the boss at the end of it, at first, defeated me very quickly. And I thought, this is weird. I mean, I played this level. And then I realized to defeat that boss, you had to use the roll command in a certain way very well. And I realized, well, I learned to do it, but I didn't really learn to do it well. And the boss is saying, you know what? Maybe you should play the level again because you really, that part's going to be more important on the next level. So then, you know, I go back and practice it, defeat him easily, right? To me, that's great. I mean, so the game is saying, we know you're good enough because you got out of the level, but you're not really good enough unless you can innovate with what you learned and really assess, did you pay enough attention? Did you work hard enough? And then you go on, and that's the way school ought to be.
We maybe the boss will just make you pleasantly frustrated one more time.
Yeah.
I was just thinking then, I just heard my son shouting at a computer downstairs. There's definitely something at stake in the Earnshaw household today.
Yeah.
And that's my reflection. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? So maybe the fact we have to do the test is because, and if people do poorly in the test, it might be because we just haven't created enough well-designed algebra experiences for people.
Right. No, see, I would say you should design algebra in the way in which you're guaranteed the person knows algebra when they finish it. Then we don't need a final test. We need a boss battle that introduces you to innovation and to what you may need in the next level, right? There is such a game. So, you know, Cisco, a big corporation years ago, built and gave away free a game to teach people to work on networks, routers and stuff, right? So it's a whole system, a network of routers and connections, and you do it in the game. And this was to train their workers, but also they did it, gave it to high school kids because it teaches you about networks and routing and all. And the game is brilliant because it's a set of problems. It built just like a game, levels, you did it, it works or it doesn't. And what's interesting is it is perfectly a game in which there is no final test because you cannot finish it and not know how to do a router, right? It's just built that way, just like, no. So, and kids love it, it's great, but it would be asking in that game, should we give you a Halo test when you finished Halo on hard, would you give the test to this? No, the test really is the whole game, right? Algebra could be done that way, but not in a system that demands we sort people. See, look, in real learning, time is not the main issue at all, right? Nobody says, it's never happened that a guy wins the Nobel Prize for physics, and they say to him, well, you know, you really don't deserve this because it took you 12 years to learn physics and Joe over there learned it in 4. So he deserves the Nobel Prize. Nobody even cares how long it took you to learn something if you win the Nobel Prize. Why do we care that you learned algebra in 6 weeks and I learned it in 6 months? Who cares? What we care about is, can I do anything with it? And school is about time. The people who are quick, you learn it faster than me, you're better than me. Your proof is shorter, you're better than me. Maybe, by the way, that I took more time and I had longer proofs and had to learn to shorten them, maybe it meant I learned a much more creative way of problem solving in algebra than you did. You know, one of the really interesting findings of the early work on games for learning was that in many of these problem solving games, women and girls did better than boys.
Of course they did.
See, and everybody said, whoa, well, you know, they're not gamers. So here's why. The boys' attitude was, I'm good at this if I can beat each level as fast as possible. The girls' attitude was, I want to beat the level, but I want to find multiple ways to do it. I want to see if there's another way to do it. Well, of course, that's the way of learning, right? You don't want to just succeed. You want to see, are there other ways? Are there innovative ways? Are there creative ways? Is there a way to really do this in a way nobody's done it? So the girls learn more. The boys still had this idea that being fast and quick means you're smart or you're good. That time is important. Time is irrelevant.
Yeah, I'm gonna come back to that in a second. Just a couple of things that's going through my brain. One is every time you talk about sorting people, my heart breaks a little bit more. Something I see a lot in sport is kids that are on level 9, 10, but actually the adults are putting them on level 1, and they're getting the adults are getting not quite so pleasantly frustrated.
Yes.
They aren't performing the skills they want, but they're just not that. It's just not that meaningful to them, so they're getting frustrated. And something I would also hear, you know, is players, they want to be challenged. They're the ones that want to move it forward. But actually, often as teachers or coaches, we're holding them back a little bit. If I'm honest.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, again, I don't know any case where somebody said a pitcher who won 20 games, well, geez, you were 28 before you got in the big leagues, so we just took your wins away. You know, no team's going to say, I'm not hiring this guy because he was a little bit late.
Yeah.
Because once he can play, you're going to get the advantage of that. See, there are people, you know, maybe, you know, there are some people who are kind of naturals at a sport, but it doesn't mean they're going to be the best, because they still have to learn to play with others and learn to innovate and learn to adapt to change. And this idea that, you know, if you're not good at something kind of by birth, you shouldn't do it. You know, the sort of foundations of all we know about electricity and electromagnetism is from Faraday. And that field is considered something only a person with high-level math abilities can master. He was terrible at math. He never mastered math. He transformed a mathematical field. Now, we don't put on his statue, well, he was one of the greatest scientists of all time, but the sucker didn't know math, right?
He definitely, he should have an asterisk after his name, I
think. Yeah, right, he should have it. What about Mendel? So when Mendel was a monk, he wanted to become a biology teacher, and he failed his biology test to be a teacher. So he sent back to the monastery to do the garden. And we realize, and by the way, the other monks called him, they thought he was stupid, right? They said nasty things about him. Now we realize that in the 19th century, Mendel was the only person who knew biology, the only one. Darwin died never knowing how genetics was the source of change and evolution, genes, but he had Mendel's paper, but he had never cut the pages and had never read it.
Wow.
Now think about it. So the dumb monk who failed his bio test was the only person who knew biology in the 19th century.
I love the and you've referenced it a couple of times there. I love the stuff you talk about with females around the multiple roots. Now, the other language you use that I really like, and I think, and I'm just trying to translate it into sport, where often we'll go game plan. Here's the game plan, and we stick to it. Is actually, well, we're going to explore some stuff. We're going to think laterally, so we might try and.
Very good point.
And then we'll rethink our goals. So we'll reassess.
So that's a very good point. One thing I had in the book, and I learned the way my generation, baby boomers, learned in school, what they learned is people are smart the faster they get to their goals. Games, if you play a game with that baby boom mentality, you fail, because the game teaches you another view of intelligence. It's not how fast you can get to goals. It's how well you can explore the terrain and your ability to think laterally, not just linearly, and to rethink your goals when you need to, right? Now, I thought this was, you know, after the Vietnam War and all the wars in the Middle East, a guy like George Bush the Younger really had a baby boom mentality. The way to win this is have a goal, stick to it, linearly get there and get there fast. We would never have been in those wars if he had had a gamer mentality and say, explore before you move too fast, think of alternatives, and if you need to, rethink your goals, because he would have determined not to go. He would have rethought his goals. See, he didn't really fully understand that Sunnis and Shiites hated each other. He said at one point, well, they're all Islamic, aren't they? But once you, if you said, well, I don't want to rush here, maybe I should check that because I might get shot if I'm wrong in a game, you would have found out that all you're going to do by going to war there is create a civil war, because the dictator was keeping the two sides from killing each other. And once you took one side an advantage, it just killed the others and they started to fight. So you would say, well, the way to make this a democratic society is certainly not to go in there, immediately kill the dictator. All I'll get is a big mess. Maybe I want to try something else that isn't war, right? That's what a game would do, right? That's what a gamer would do.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's why it's very sad. We're running baby boomers, Trump and Biden, who, you know, rather than gamer generation people who really are born to think collaboratively and about lateral thinking and exploration, rethinking goals, and then certainly rethinking failure and trying something new, not just trying the same thing again and again. You notice how we did Vietnam and said you cannot win a war on where the guerrilla fighters are on their own territory. And then we didn't learn anything. We did it again in Iraq and Afghanistan. And we haven't learned anything there because now people want us to invade Iran, right? So this is not me thinking goals. It's a linear drive to your goal with and not using failure as learning, right? They learned nothing from the failure. But in this case, lives are being lost. I said once, no politician should be allowed to be a mayor, a congressman, president if they haven't won several rounds of civilization.
It's so true.
Yeah, right.
And we got exactly the same here. I mean, we wouldn't be heading, and people, you know, my Twitter feed is often full of political viewpoints, but it's heading headlong into a car crash that's Brexit.
Oh, yes.
We're completely unable to kind of reassess our goals, to think laterally. But
actually,
part of the problem is that we're not willing to change what is our traditional political system and how we vote and how people get into power, which is...
It's like the schools. The political system is really there to advantage certain people, politicians in league with certain vested interests. And the politics, you know, there's interesting things that show that if you take an American congressional district or take a senator or a congressman, and you give their constituents a survey of all the issues that are important to them. So poor people list what's important to them, and middle class people what's important to them, and rich people what's important to them. And then you look at how that congressman or senator voted. They only represent the issues that the rich people said they were interested in. They do not represent at all the ones the poor say they're interested in, and they barely represent many of the interests in the middle. So literally, they're there to represent the interests of the wealthy. I mean, the system works well, right? We have the highest inequality, that is the most wealth in the smallest hands. If the system was designed to do that, it's excellent. It's doing very well. See, so we go and say, well, it's failing because we think its goal is democracy. It's not failing, it's working beautifully. It has to be replaced.
You're breaking my heart again, Jay. it's tough. It's a tough gig.
Nobody wants to play an easy game. You know, Americans in sport, all you know, the other thing every American learned in sport is the most dramatic thing is to lose heroically, right? The you know, going to the bitter end, fighting it out and losing it's even better than winning.
Talk a lot about kind of production. I might talk about like co-creation, about agency, about choice. Actually, I think you talk a little bit in the book about actually the kids are having autonomy around the curriculum, which would really excite me again. But lots of people.
Well, see, no, autonomy. They should have shared autonomy because, look, if you're in an affinity space and you're working with people to make an app for a game you play, you want to have a role, you want to have autonomy in that role, but you want the people who have more knowledge than you to also influence your autonomy so it's successful. Right, it's that collaboration can't be autonomy for every individual. It means we want you to do your role well, but we want you to know when it's time to cede expertise to others and seek that out. Right? See, that it seeking out expertise for others when you need it is called cheating in school, but it is essential. You know, every athlete learns not just from the coach, but from the better athletes, right? And a team and good, humane athletes who are good do all they can to make the other players better.
Right? Can I tell you a heartbreaking story?
Sure.
So one of our friends, I was chatting to the parents and she got put in an isolation booth for 7 hours. For helping someone else out in a lesson. It just broke my heart even more. But it was interesting because I had the conversation with the parents and because it's just become normalized in that school.
Yeah.
They didn't, until I kind of said, well, hang on a second, this is, you know, cheating as it's not even cheating. She's just helping.
Yeah. Right.
It's essential. Yeah. And it's a really useful, and it's actually caring, and the person who's being supported would feel belonging, and the person that's
right.
explaining it is gonna get better at explaining stuff. And
yeah, I mean, it's insane. It's insane. Even if what you should have done is realize that person needed help, and instead of calling what she did cheating, you would have said, hey, let's kind of formalize this. Why don't you two work together? Because he needs your help and you have some expertise and you'll learn a lot by teaching him, right? It's what we do with an athlete. You know, you'd say, you know, you're not really good at hitting curveballs. This guy is, so why don't you work with him? He'll coach you, not me, because he's good at it. That's what you would do. You know, I remember when I was playing World of Warcraft and I was in the five-person little hunting group and was a priest where you're mainly supposed to heal people and buff them. You're not supposed to kill anything. You're supposed to just help others. And, you know, we were in a raid and stuff, and I was doing something wrong where things weren't working well. And a guy, see, remember, he was a tank, but he also had an alt as a priest. So he knew both of those roles. He just came up to me and said, what you don't realize is when it looks this way, you should use that skill at that moment. When he just said, it was just in time. And when he said it, the whole thing became clear. And I became a much better priest. Nobody said, Jim, now you will lose all the credit because somebody told you. You were supposed to discover it yourself while all of us died repeatedly. But why? It's to his advantage. He's not saying I want Jim to fail because he's failing because I'm failing. So he comes up and does Matt. Now notice why his main role was his tank, but he had an alt and he played it. So he understood what priests should do, even though he was not being a priest that moment. And came and told me, and then we collaborated. We all got better.
Well, I don't know if you have isolation booths in America.
But well, if they, yeah.
Yeah. In England, at a certain school in Bristol, you would get put in an isolation booth.
Well, so that's another example. The literature has shown repeatedly that the thing that if you want to hurt a human the most, isolate. You know, isolation in prison is by far the most inhumane thing you can do to people because human beings are herd animals, social animals. They will get very sick if you cut them off from sociality. But one of the reasons young people in this virus are having such a hard time. So if you wanted to torture humans, then having the isolation booth is a great idea.
My heart broke one more little bit there. you said about something else you mentioned was like computer games used to have manuals, and I remember that. So I haven't played a computer game in a very long time, but I remember like Harrier Attack, and they actually had a bit of a manual that came with the cassette. So when you were loading,
they do, So and when I was originally playing, they had manuals, and I have this in the book that I. In one of the first games I played, it was a little 20-page manual, and I had this. I tried to read it before playing the game, and I understood every word, but I still didn't know what any of it meant, and I certainly didn't know what it was going to look like in the game. It was useless. And so then I played the game and played it badly, but got better and better. And when I was interesting, as I was getting better and then felt I really need to know a little more about what's happening here, I picked up the manual again and it was completely clear. I understood it all and I could learn from it. You see, and my argument was kids knew a fundamental learning principle. Do before you read. Don't read first, read second, because the words are about the world. Go live in that world. And then when you come back to the words, you have vivid images for them all. Read the book without the world, and you have no real idea what it means. And so any kid, of course, would never have read the book first, only a baby boomer or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's when I realized, boy, the world's changed. And the way baby boomers do things, it's no longer that great. So any teacher ought to know. See, that's what handing a kid a textbook in biology before they've played any biology is just like giving them a manual for a game. They don't have any idea what it looks like. And it's 500 pages long.
Yeah, it's stressful.
Yes. On the other hand, you see, my argument is just as if you play a video game for hours, the manual will make complete sense. If you played biology for hours, the textbook would make complete sense. And here's the problem. Everybody would pass. Couldn't sort.
Couldn't sort them. Oh, God. I was thinking a bit about, coaching as an example is that often people, and will do coaching degrees and they actually won't get on the pitch and coach that much. So they don't have some experiences to make sense on what to go, so perception actions this and power dynamics.
Yeah, so any coach obviously should have played the sport. But interesting enough, just like with conductors, you do not have to have been excellent at the sport to be a good coach. It's because some people who are not that good at it get a very good understanding of it. See, I'll tell you an example. When I was quite young, my godfather owned a minor league baseball team. And I would go with him. It was a class A, so pretty low, and in a real rural town. And when I went with him to watch the games, and I stayed in the motel room with the coach, the head coach, this guy named Sparky Anderson. He had been what they call a cup of coffee baseball player. He'd been in the majors for like 1 year. And he's in this, you know, A league coaching. And a nice guy, he put up with me, and I would ask, I liked him. And, a few years later, he's coaching in the big leagues for Cincinnati. They go to three, multiple World Series. Then he coaches another team. He's now in the Hall of Fame. He's a very famous Hall of Fame manager, a cup of coffee baseball player who learned his coaching skill way down the line, and anybody would have dismissed as a loser, is in the Hall of Fame.
Why do you think that? Because that's something, well, I'm actually right.
Sparky had See, coaching and conducting require you to be able to play the game and understand the game at a physical level. But they also demand a set of skills about empathy, human relationships, building trust that not every good athlete has. And I knew as a young person with Sparky, he had a certain humanness, charisma, ability to motivate, ability to understand and sympathize, and to build trust with people that was a human. Not everybody had it. And people wanted to win for him. They wanted to do stuff. He wasn't, you know, and it, the players in his A-League team were highly motivated. And then when he went to the big leagues, they were highly motivated. It's just good. So look, I mean, you know, a conductor probably knows how to play some instruments. They don't have to have been great. They have to know what you're doing. And they have to know how to make you better. And they may have skills that are people skills, and also understanding of kind of what is this really about? You know, what makes a good baseball team, not just a good baseball player? And maybe he understood that. But it's gratifying to know you don't have to be an expert at the skill to help people become experts at the skill.
Yeah, it's someone described coaching to me as a contact sport, and you have contact with other human beings. And
yeah. That's a good way to put it. He was good at two contact sports, baseball and human relationships.
Yeah, no, it's just an interesting one because at the moment there'll be, yeah, I'm just writing a piece around this, around players who very quickly become coaches, and often mm-hmm. they're not supported as well, which makes it really tricky too, because they don't have an elder who's helping them with their
value. Yeah, well, Sparky paid his dues in the minor leagues, right? And he proved himself. He wasn't in them an exorbitantly long time. Then he was famous. You got to stay in the game, right? If Parkey had said, wow, I'm out here in this rural town, a big loser, I think I'll go work at McDonald's, he wouldn't be in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, no, that's pretty cool. Something you mentioned as well, I'm thinking about where video game design will go in the future, and I know you've referenced that the military have done this well. You speak a little bit about, like, in computer games, like shooting is almost like used because it's quite a basic interaction between people.
Well, it was easy one to program. So if you look at the early games, I mean, you know, you take the early shooters, shooting is easy to program, and what you did is they were like run and gun. You just shot constantly. Then you look at the modern shooters like Metal Gear, the later Metal Gear Solid. They're not really shooters because they're stealth games, right? And in fact, although Deus Ex, one of my all-time favorite games, and it was one of the early games I played, I went out and thought, well, it's a shooter, so I shot everybody. And then I had to go back to my base and get more ammunition. And the guy, you know, computer character, giving me the ammunition, said, you know, we're in this military. We're not really here just to kill people. If you can solve problems without killing people, you ought to do it. So I'm not going to give you any more ammunition. That's what the game said. And now you get these games like the recent Last of Us and they could have killing and shooting in them, but there's many more things you're doing, solving problems, working in relationships. And of course, we have now infinite number of games that don't involve shooting at all, right? Dragon Box, which is a game to learn algebra, is just brilliant. It's a really fun game. And it really teaches you algebra in a way, solving equations that you actually, for the first time, understand what you're doing and why you're doing it, and that it is a game. It's not just memorizing stuff. It's made in the Netherlands. It's sold very well. Excellent game. I played it just for fun. And, you know, I was never any good at algebra, and I'm still not good at it. But the first time I ever understood what you were supposed to be doing was when I played that game. And I said, why in the hell didn't people tell me this? Would have motivated me so much more.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And you mentioned the military. So, you feel like they've taken some of this stuff and actually applied it, and it's had impact.
They do, because not only have they used the learning principles that I talked about, but later on with MacArthur, I worked with a lot of top assessment people around a thing called evidence-centered design, made up by a guy named Bob Bislevy, as a form of assessment that really is not just a score, but the evidence for why you're good at this or bad at this and what you can do about it. Mm-hmm. And the military pretty much demands that any game that they buy for training is assessed by ECD, right? Which is the way assessment works, let's say, in Rise of Nations and real-time strategy games. Multiple variables, giving you the evidence for it, and with some in such a way that then you next time you play, you're thinking in a different way. Remember, their motivation was, we didn't do this because we like it. We did this because we really don't want our soldiers to die.
Yeah, that'd be good feedback to the schools. They could.
It's interesting that I have found, I mean, this will get me in a lot of trouble, that the American Army, the people I've dealt with in it, have a stronger sense of ethics than many people I've dealt with either in business or education. And their business is killing. It's a sad statement.
Yeah, wow.
Now, I must go. I'm going to go hike, and then I have to take care of my animals who are waiting to get fed. This has been a lot of fun. I hope you can use it.
No, James, I was going to say, I really thank you. I really appreciate your time. And my last piece of feedback was, you've got the best chapter titles in any book I've ever read.
Great.
Is playing video games a waste of time? Why doesn't Lara Croft obey Professor Von Krauy? Do you want to be the Blue Sonic or the Dark Sonic? So
that's because they all came out of real experiences, right? I'm glad you like that. I think that's great. It's good.
Now, look, I really appreciate your time. It's been awesome. And as I said, thank you so much for
You are welcome. Good luck with your work. You're one of the good ones. Save the world for us.
Good. Well, mate, go and enjoy feeding the animals. Cheers, James.
Bye-bye.